All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing editor Natasha Bogutsky.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief Rich Dries. How's it going, Rich?
Oh, boy, am I tired.
Oh, boy. Right out of the gate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a good tired, though. I mean, I just came from like a weekend in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Film Festival.
Rubbing it in, why don't you?
I'm sorry. I know you wanted to go and see...
Party's Just Beginning.
Yes, which we both saw at Tribeca and loved. And yes, I did sneak in a second showing of that for myself. And I did.
Of course you did.
Did sneak in a second showing of Bathtubs Over Broadway because I just...
Of course.
Oh, God. I just fell in love with that movie all over again. It's just so damn charming and fun and light and wonderful and... And I cannot wait for this movie to get picked up and get some distribution so people can see it outside of the festival circuit. I mean, eventually it'll show up on like Netflix or something like that. But I hope eventually is like soon, not later.
Sam, I was a little worried because I heard Orchard picked up Party's Just Beginning, but we hadn't received any information about when it was going to be released until Karen Gillan mentioned at Ace Comic Con that it was scheduled for a December 7th release. She didn't say whether or not that was going to be DVD or if it was going to be streaming or cinema, but... We'll find out.
And even if it's in theaters, if it's going to be a limited release and then go get wider, or if it's just going to be like a small targeted release, knowing Orchard, it's probably going to be a smaller theatrical release and then followed by home video and streaming.
Hey, at least we have a date now and I'm not, yes. I'm not like shuffling around the internet going, I need to find a piece of information. All they said was fall. Well, guess what? It's freaking fall.
October, December 7th is...
Still fall.
Still fall, technically.
Yeah.
So, barely, but...
yeah, it's right on the cusp there.
Mm. And we have both seen in the last week or so, week and a half, 2 weeks, a lot of movies outside of both the film festival stuff that I saw, which I'll run down really quickly. I saw the new, quote-unquote, Orson Welles film, Other Side of the Wind, and I was blown away by it. As I sort of expected I would be, although I had a little trepidation because it was kind of shot in fits and starts over a couple of years and Welles could never get the money to really complete it and there were a lot of issues with the production. So I was a little afraid that it wasn't going to really kind of hang together all that well, but thankfully it does. That's going to show up first week of November on Netflix, along with a documentary called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is about the production of the movie. And I saw both of those features back to back. They're, you know, and they really work well together. The Welles film itself, though, Other Side of the Wind, is really interesting in that it doesn't feel like a regular Orson Welles film. There's a lot of things he's doing in there that are new and different, so it's fun to see him experimenting like that, and that the experiments give you such good dividends. And, surprise, surprise, it appears that Orson Welles is actually the inventor of the found footage genre.
Oh, really?
Yes. Now, the conceit that this movie is that it's... The last night in the life of a movie director. It all takes place at this party at his home. And he invited all these people in who had video cameras. Excuse me, not video cameras, but film cameras. You know, it was filmed in 1972, 73. So they all have like film cameras, you know, 16 millimeter film cameras, 35. They're, you know, documentary film students. And they're all like shooting all sorts of stuff around this party. The conceit is that all these different pieces of footage that were filmed at this party are put together after the fact to kind of get an idea of what happened on the last night of this guy's life. So basically, it's a found footage movie.
That's pretty awesome.
I know. 20 some years before Blair Witch Project, Orson Welles created the found footage genre. Holy shit. And we never knew it.
Pull your pants there, buddy.
I know. It's amazing. It's just like, what? That was like an exciting revelation to see in this movie. So I would recommend it to a lot of people just for that. There's a lot of some other things in there that Wells is doing. He's commenting on his own fame. He's commenting on the film school generation of directors that were just starting to make their mark in Hollywood. He's commenting on European realism cinema from the 60s with this film within the film, you know, the film that the director that the story is about is making. There's a lot of interesting things going on in this movie. And I try to unwrap a lot of that in my review over on Film Buff Online, but I don't think I get to it all, because you really need to see this film a couple of times to really get to grasp and wrestle with it. And once it shows up on Netflix next month,
you're going to be queuing it.
I am really looking forward to going back to this movie and seeing what else I can find and discover about it.
Well, while you were handling Philly Film Fest, mm-hmm. I had taken some time to go see some of the newer releases in the film and revisit some films I'd never seen before, such as Hellraiser.
Hellraiser, okay.
It's Halloween time. Yes, I had this sneaking one I'd never seen.
Okay. And we'll be getting to some other Halloween films that we have not seen a little bit later in the show. But first, I've lived with Hellraiser since I saw it in college, umbity years ago. So what were your impressions?
Twisted magic. It's the first thing that popped into my head.
I like that. That's a good description.
Loved it.
Good. I love the world building that Barker is doing there. It's deliciously twisted and warped. And it comments on letting your desires get out of control and things like that. And it's really interesting when you start to kind of like look at that.
Yeah, I noticed mm-hmm. that it's not the Cenobites who are the villains of the piece. It's actually the humans and the choices that we make for each other. Mm-hmm. We are both hero and villain. The Cenobites,
they're just the punishment.
Yeah, they are the reward or the punishment, however you choose to see it.
True. It did okay at the box office, as I recall, but it was enough that it kicked off a franchise, as things happen in the 80s. And the second one is really good as well. I like that.
I haven't seen it.
I'm not going to say anything about it. I'm just saying I liked it. The third one on, you're probably good with just skipping those.
I did notice that Kirstie, the daughter, mm-hmm. has an 80s Jennifer Connelly vibe going on.
Ashley Laurent, if I'm remembering the name exactly. Yeah, she's a good actress. I've seen her in stuff outside of the franchise. I think she's only in the first two. And then she makes her escape out of the franchise several years ago, actually at the Philadelphia Film Festival. I saw her in a film called Firefly, which was about a young kid growing up in Alabama in the 80s who loved horror movies. They were his escape. And, you know, he would always read Fangoria magazine and stuff like that. And he liked films like Hellraiser. And she played his mother.
No, that's brilliant.
And she was at the screening, actually. And I got to meet her and chat with her for a moment or two. A lovely, very delightful woman.
Ashley Lawrence.
Close. Let's see. Now, we also, both of us, did see Beautiful Boy.
Oh, that's who that was.
What?
No.
Oh, let's back up. Okay.
Yeah, back up for a second. I had been sitting all through Hellraiser trying to figure out why I know Julia. Why do I know Julia? Claire mm-hmm. Higgins. Mm-hmm. And it had been bugging me. And it just hit me. Ready Player One. The Golden Compass. There's a bunch of films here that I had seen her in over the years, and then put two together.
Who is she
together.
In Ready Player One? Is she the aunt
that
Percival lives with?
I don't think so. Hold on.
I don't know why I'm going down a Ready Player One rabbit hole, honestly. I don't think it was that great a movie.
I actually really liked it. It was fun.
Yeah,
Mrs.
but...
Mrs. Gilmore. That's going to bug me now.
Okay.
You're like, I'm not following this any further.
Yeah, no, I'm out. Blackjack hands. I'm clean and I'm out.
Okay. She was in The Libertine, House of Mirth, okay. Parade's End. That, okay, with Benedict Cumberbatch, which mm-hmm. I have. Toast with Helena Bonham Carter and Freddie Highmore, which is really good. Casanova with David Tennant.
Casanova, the three-part miniseries?
Yeah, she's okay. in it.
Oh, gosh. Well,
she's
I haven't seen that since
She has definitely quite a filmography going on.
I haven't seen Casanova, though, since it originally came out. The second they announced David Tennant was going to be in Doctor Who, I started like going, okay, who's this guy? And Casanova was one of the things I came across and I watched. And I really liked the first part and a half where he's kind of more the bon vivant before, you know, everything goes to crap for him. You know, that's when I was like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to be a good doctor.
She's on Into the Badlands right now.
Oh.
Yeah, she has quite the filmography. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she was also on Doctor Who.
Oh, where? When?
She is the head of the Sisterhood of Khan.
Oh! Oh, my goodness, yes.
I she was amazing in that. Mm-hmm. So now I know why I know her.
Okay. Sometimes I'm bad with, and you know this, and you've yelled at me about this. Sometimes I am kind of bad with like placing a face to a name and a role, especially if there's a bit of time between the two performances. You know, I'll be like, oh, okay, yeah. Once it's pointed out to me, it's so obvious. But until it's pointed out to me, I'm just like, oh, I don't know.
No, you and I are both that way. Mm. It's one of those that's going to bug me and bug me and bug me. And then, holy shit.
Really quickly, though, I did want to hit two of the Oscar contenders that we have both seen that we're not going to do a review on, but I did want to just kind of throw out some impressions on. So first of all, Beautiful Boy. I know you were looking forward to it because you're a big Timothée Chalamet fan.
Yes.
And what did you feel?
I thought the performances were steady. Steve Carell gives a fantastic turn in this film. The storytelling is not as good.
For me, the thing that kind of bugs me about that movie is the movie just stops. It doesn't end. It just kind of stops and gives you a title card telling you what happens over the next 8 years, which is kind of crappy. Now, granted, maybe if you have a story this long where you just go, oh, 2 hours, we're done, and you have to still tell people in a title card what happens for the next 8 years, maybe film isn't the proper medium for that story. Maybe a Netflix series, a limited series on Netflix or Amazon might be a better place. And especially on a pay service like that, you could go into some darker places with that story. You could do that, also on like Netflix or something like that, you know, and tell it in like a 10-hour season of just boom, Beautiful Boy. And you're telling it from both of the perspectives and stuff like that. And you can get a lot deeper into some of the characters and things, which I don't think the movie did as well as it could have. But yes, I agree. The performances were fantastic. Mm. And again, also the performances were fantastic in A Star is Born.
I think Star is Born actually had a more solid story.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they've had how many remakes of this now to work it out? So we know what works. Just stick to the story that, you know, have been successful in the 30s, the 50s, the 70s, and now. My problem is the end of the movie needs something to happen. And I'm trying to keep it a spoiler, you know, not be a spoiler about this for people who haven't seen it yet. But I don't think the movie earns it entirely.
No, you're right.
Yeah, somebody comes up and says something to another character, which is the trigger for this event. And I don't think the person who says it is set up to be that.
We are still talking about the same film, right?
Yes.
Which one?
Star is Born.
No.
Oh.
I was thinking Beautiful Boy.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. No, Star is Born.
I'm okay with how they went there.
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Like I was saying, I don't think the character who says the things that instigates the action is set up to be that kind of a person who would say that. I don't think we're shown where the person who takes the action is in a mental state that they would go ahead and do that
action.
The
person who takes the action was absolutely there.
You think so?
Yes.
I didn't get that feeling. And
what have I told you about it's not when they're showing it that you have to be scared. It's when they're at their most calm.
True. Yes. Even by saying that, I think we're kind of maybe giving a hint out as to what might be happening there. And I don't want to do that, even though I didn't think the
movie film's been out for almost a month at this point.
True, but still.
I don't know a lot of people who haven't seen it.
True. But even though I don't think the movie quite earned the moment, it was still very impactful to me and emotional to me. So mission accomplished, I guess.
I'm very proud. They didn't really have to show it, but they showed enough to let the audience realize and what react.
Happened. Yes, yes.
That poor puppy.
Oh, I know.
That's what killed you, wasn't it? It was the puppy outside the door.
That might have had a part in it, yes.
Yeah, I figured.
Okay. Well, we'll be right back with a look at some trailers that did drop this week.
Rachel.
Hello, Lewis.
Oh, look at you. They're still finding bodies. It's chaos out there.
This house is being requisitioned by the British government.
This is jetzt Ihr Haus. Aber wir haben uns.
Hey, Lewis.
Hello, Morgan. Please come inside.
This is my wife.
My daughter and I will stay out of your way until we move to the camp.
What if we let them stay on?
You mean live with them?
There may not be an outward show of hatred, but it's there below the surface.
During the war, did you ever hope for a German victory? Did the bombing affect the health of you and your family?
It affected the health of my wife. She died in the firestorm.
I'm so sorry. You didn't tell me what I was walking into. This isn't how it was supposed to be.
None of this is how it is supposed to be.
Please don't go.
I have a job to do.
If you're going to spy on a girl, the least you could do is pay her a compliment.
Yes, of course.
Something's changed. Be careful, that's all. They don't like us.
I never thought that I could be happy like this.
Come with me. This is what you wanted.
To new beginnings.
So Jason Clarke is going to kill the person who's having an affair with his wife. How very Great Gatsby of him. Wow. I'm sorry. It was just his part.
Some people just get typecast, I guess.
Honest to God, I saw that shot. It was the first thing that popped into my head, although I will be seeing this.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I will, too. I'm interested in the... Honestly, I think I might be a little bit more interested in the background history. Of the story where it's very, hey, the Allies won, but there's still a very deep resentment, obviously, with the German people. The Allies don't look 100% angelic by going in and saying, hey, we're requisitioning your house. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some moral ambiguity going on there that I don't think I've ever seen addressed in a movie before about the immediate post-war era of Europe.
The thing that I caught that I found interesting was when they said, was when Alexander said, we'll stay here until they move us to the camp. And the first thing I thought of was, what camp?
Yeah, that kind of did jump out at me, too.
I don't know a lot about...
Neither do I.
The...
The media post-war era outside of, you know, it was just nuts, you know, in terms, you know, and they say it right there. It's chaos out there.
Yeah, because I know that you had the Russians coming in, the Americans coming in, Berlin got split and there was all of that. But they're still picking up the pieces. This takes place in Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be as insane as Berlin, but it's still going to be nuts.
Oh, yeah. I'm very interested to see that. And hopefully there'll be some interesting like history pieces that come out when this movie comes out too, just to kind of help put things in context, because I'd love to read something like that.
And the one thing that's bugging me is this feels like it's supposed to be Oscar baity, but it's slated for 2019.
Yeah, an Oscar bait movie would not be having a
February
release, because they always try to pack that stuff from like October through the end of the year.
Sometimes and there's certainly a couple that fall in spring, but
yeah,
they usually get skated over.
Get Out came out in what, February? February, March, somewhere?
I thought it was a summer movie.
Of last year? Yeah, it fell out of the traditional spot, but I think no one was expecting.
And it was a genre film. No one had expected it to go as far as it did.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, it's not a genre film. It's a genre film with a
Oscar pedigree.
And satire.
Yeah. And it's certainly, you know, far too early to be dropping a trailer for next year's Oscar season.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why this film is being dropped in April of this coming year.
I have a feeling it's going to be a limited release. We'll be lucky if we see it in this area for like a week.
Fox Searchlight. Yeah, it feels more like a Fox Searchlight limited release film. Hopefully, you know, they'll be able to keep it in the conversation when the time comes for awards season.
I hope so.
If that's, you know, exactly what they're shooting for.
Well, that will all depend on the pedigree of the film.
True. So we'll find out at the end of April, I guess. But moving on from a post-war drama to something that might be a little bit more thriller-ish, a little bit more horror-ish, we've got our first look at the upcoming film, Escape Room.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, and they all look just the same.
You want to control your life, but life isn't a science experiment. You can't contain your world forever. Try doing one thing that scares you over break, okay?
Yeah. This serves as an entry voucher.
For Minos escape rooms.
Be the first to escape our most immersive room yet.
And win $1 million.
So, when does the game start?
I think this is the escape room.
We should look for clues.
What are we looking for here?
Anything that looks like a puzzle or a code.
It looks like an oven dial.
That looks real.
It's kind of warming up in here.
Excuse me. We'd like our hit now, please.
Well, that's creepy as hell.
Is it getting hotter?
How do we get out of here?
It's Fahrenheit 451.
About immersive.
What's wrong with you? That was real.
Whoa.
Dumb question. Are we outside?
So we get this figured out, so we get the hell out of here.
Who would do this?
They know every move that we're making.
They knew everything about us.
This is my hospital bed.
Me too. They made these rooms for us.
Have you ever seen things that weren't there before?
I am not imagining this.
Surviving is a choice.
I want out.
You
let me out of here.
That's why they chose us.
And they all look just the same.
That looks really intriguing. I'm thinking like there's elements of the old science fiction film Cube in there. Maybe,
not
you know.
Cubes?
Not Cubes. Which is a great office comedy directed by my friend Jason. And it's available on Netflix in disc form. Check it out. Cube, it was a Canadian science fiction film about people who woke up all in like a 10 by 10 by 10 room, and they had to solve a puzzle to get out, and then they found themselves in another 10 by 10 by 10 room, and they keep going through trying to solve these different puzzles before each room killed them. It's a great low-budget film in terms of showing what you can do basically with one set that you just reuse over and over again different ways, and there was a couple sequels, I think, that probably aren't worth watching. The idea that they're like in these rooms and having to solve puzzles to get out kind of reminded me of that. A little bit reminded me of Saw.
For some reason, I have no idea where I got this correlation, but it's reminded me of the Belko experiment.
Okay, I can see that. I can see that a little bit in there. Interesting cast.
I only recognized one person. And I'm pretty sure it's the same person you're going to go through, right?
Deborah Ann Wall?
Yeah, I mean, she's got to find something else to do now that Luke Cage and Iron Fist have now been canceled. So her repertoire of shows that she can hop from are getting smaller. Yeah,
unfortunately. Damn you, Netflix. I might be part of the problem, though, because I'm still like 3/4 of the way through Jessica Jones season 2.
I'm midway through Luke Cage season 2 right now.
Okay.
Granted, I skipped Punisher completely. But, sorry, Deborah.
But the bearded gentleman in there was Tyler Labine.
Okay.
One of the other people in there is Nick Dadani, who is on the new reboot of Murphy Brown.
Really?
Yes.
I haven't started it yet. Is it good?
I'm enjoying it. I think some of the political points are a little... They feel like they're kind of like a half beat behind the rest of the culture because it's in a sitcom, which has a longer lead time versus like Saturday Night Live or any of the late night comics. They can make that point quicker by the nature of their shows versus what Murphy Brown is doing. But when it kind of expands itself...
Will and Grace does it pretty well.
True. But, you know, even then, they're still like, you know, it feels like they're always like a half step behind just because there's like, at best, a week or two lead in between when they record something and it hits the air. They don't have the luxury of just being nuts about it like South Park, where they can literally will write an episode Sunday night and it'll air on Wednesday. But those guys are insane workaholics.
Yeah, you ain't kidding.
There was a great documentary that came out a couple of years ago about one work week at South Park. And it literally is them sitting around going, okay, what are we going to... We have 6 days until we have an episode that needs to be aired. What are we going to do? They can change things literally up until like the last moment by the way they work. You know, as long as they have it entirely finished and locked in like the hour and a half they need to drive the tape from their studio to the satellite uplink to Comedy Central. Comedy Central's like, as long as you get it to us by 3 minutes before it's supposed to air, we're fine. We don't care how long it takes you. We trust you. You know our standards and practices. You're not going to go overboard and do whatever. So, you know, they just let them go.
Well, yeah, which I think is amazing. They've been doing for what, 20, 25 years almost at this point?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. By the,
they've earned that.
If you don't have a working relationship that is that good by then, you're doing something wrong.
True. But this looks really interesting. I like the premise. I like what we see here. We're getting a little bit of, you know, how obviously, you know, we're putting characters into a pressure cooker. Kind of literally at one point, it looks like. And seeing how they react with each other. My biggest complaint about this movie?
Yes.
It's set for January.
I was just about to say something about that.
Yeah, it's a January 4th release.
Which means it will not get a lot of traction at all. Traditionally, films that are not scheduled to be big box office releases never get stuck in January.
They kind of get dumped in January. With the exception, though, January 18th, we're getting Glass from M. Night Shyamalan. And that, I think, is going to be huge because everybody's looking forward to that.
It is going to be huge. And one of the best things about sticking it in January means that they're going to top records.
Not a whole lot of other good stuff out, with the exception of long-term rollouts of Oscar movies that are going wider in smaller cities and stuff like that.
Plus, the end of December is crazy for films. Aquaman, Welcome to Marwen, Bumblebee. There's a bunch. There's like 4 or 5 that come out within like a 2-3 day span. Near the end of December.
Yeah. From December, starting at like the beginning of December, we have The Silence.
Go to the end of December. Mid to end.
I'm just scrolling down. The Invisibles, Mary's Queen of Scots, Under the Silver Lake, Vox Lux. That's just on the 7th. The 14th, we've got The Mortal Engines and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
There's two big
ones
right
there. And then The Mule, which is a crime drama from Warner Brothers. The 21st, we have Aquaman, Bumblebee, second act. Welcome to Marwen, whatever that Deadpool re-release thing is going to be. And then the 19th, Mary Poppins Returns.
That one's going to be big.
The 26th, or actually on the 25th, we have Vice and Holmes and Watson. Holmes and Watson's going to be big. Vice, I'm hoping, is going to be big.
I think Vice is going to be big in another way. It's not going to be the big box office draw. It's going to be big for award season.
True.
Vox Lux is going to be for award season. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Marwen.
And next weekend, hopefully I'll be able to tell you about that because I'm planning on seeing that.
I wanted to see it. I was looking at that on the schedule, but I was upset that they're showing it Saturday night and not Sunday when I'll be down there. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Aquaman, Bumblebee. Welcome to Marwen, unfortunately, is going to be overshadowed, and that's a shame.
Welcome to Marwen's going to just get plowed under by these other movies.
Mary Poppins. Into the Spider-Verse, Mortal Engines. Those are going to be the big ones from December that are still going to be hanging on through January and
especially
February.
January 4th. Yeah. So if people, you know, do a lot of movie going over the holiday week between Christmas and New Year's, that's great. Maybe Escape Room will have a chance.
I can tell you right now, I won't be touching Escape Room in January because I'll be catching up on all the Oscar stuff.
Probably.
Because that's what I usually do. I don't get a chance to see them usually when they get released. Because in our area, they'll pop up for a week and then they disappear. AKA Colette this past week with Keira Knightley and Dominic West was planning to get to a screening of it. And then all of a sudden, the theater chopped the screenings in half.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it affects with the actual working hours of my day job. And therefore, I was not able to get to it.
You can't run a film at 10 and 4:30, or, you know, at 1 o'clock and 4:30, Monday through Friday, and then complain that not a lot of people showed up.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, okay, you're going to get retirees coming in to see it, but how about the rest of us between the ages of 21 and 65?
Yeah.
Especially for a film like Colette, which is not appealing to, you know, teenagers. This is, you know, much more of an adult-skewing demographic for this film, and then you put it, you know, in a time slot when adults are working. It's dumb. It's just absolutely dumb. Bad move there, Cinemark.
But I will say, once it starts picking up a lot of traction during the award season, so when we had the SAGs coming up, the BAFTAs, and then there's, of course, the Golden Globes and the Oscars, you're going to have a lot of time. And when it starts picking up those nominations, they usually get longer re-releases back in our theater.
True.
And so I end up plowing through all my award season films between Christmas and February.
Oh, I know. That's good. This is like getting to be the nuts time for us on, like, we really need to be on top of everything. It's a rough couple of months in terms of watching. And, you know, I still have a bunch of stuff I need to watch in screener form and such for Philadelphia Film Festival and our coverage on Film Buff for that, too. And fortunately, next Saturday, when I'm going to be back down at the festival, I'm going to be catching a couple of Oscar potential films, like The Favorite, like Vox Lux. So,
which are showing both on Saturday.
Yep. So that's
and Party's Just Beginning that night too. Again,
no, that's on Friday coming Friday.
Oh, it is.
Excuse me.
Oh yeah, it is Friday.
Yeah, so I can't go to that either, unfortunately. But speaking of weirdly scheduled films, the last trailer we're going to take a look at here is The Prodigy, and it's coming in February of next year.
Do we have a theme going on in this podcast?
Well, you mean because it's Halloween time and we're looking at scary movies a lot?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyways, here it is, our first look at The Prodigy.
Watch the silver eye on top of the arm. Just watch. Every time it swings, let's pretend we're unraveling a piece of string, little by little. Let's pretend that piece of string is time, unraveling minute by minute. Second by second, going backwards, time slipping away. Everything around you, this house, my voice, your mother, all these things are getting further away. We're going back through your life, back to when you started school, when you first learned to walk, when you were just a baby, back to the day you were born, back to the time before this body. I'm no longer speaking to Miles. I'm speaking to the person who has taken residence inside his body. You came uninvited. Tell me if you can hear my voice.
What's wrong?
Mommy, I'm scared.
Come here, baby.
And that was just a few moments from The Prodigy, a horror movie being released next year. And that was not a teaser.
You don't think that was a teaser?
Absolutely not. It felt like the first 3 minutes of the film.
Well, they said teaser trailer right there on the video. So,
yeah.
It felt long. It didn't feel like much of a I'm not sure what it felt like, honestly. Creepy, but maybe that's because, you know, they have the kid with husky eyes. You know, one gray, one blue, or one black and one blue.
It's called, I think it's called dendrochromia or something
really?
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I call them husky eyes because huskies have eyes like that.
You mean two different color eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an actual term for that.
Yeah, I know. Husky eyes.
No.
Yes.
No.
I made it up. Yes.
Oh, please. Anyway, it also helps that they got the kid who played Georgie in the 2017 remake of the film It to play the little kid in this film.
Yeah. Honestly, though, there's nothing about this that's kind of grasping me here.
Sorry, Colm. Not even you can make me go see this. And yeah. I love your work.
Is he hypnotizing us at the beginning? Because I'm getting sleepy.
Oh, please. And that's all I have to say on the subject. Can we move on?
Yeah, okay,
that's how boring that trailer was.
Wow. All right. So we'll be right back with hopefully a very fun review of two Halloween-themed films. Stick around.
What's this? What's this? There's color everywhere. What's this? There's white things in the air. What's this? I can't believe my eyes. I must be dreaming. Wake up, Jack. This isn't fair. What's this? What's this? What's this? There's something very wrong. What's this? There's people singing songs. What's this? The streets are lined with little creatures laughing. Everybody seems so happy. Have I possibly gone daffy? What is this? What's this? There's children throwing snowballs instead of throwing heads. They're busy building toys, and absolutely no one's dead. There's frost in every window. Oh, I can't believe my eyes. And in my bones, I feel the warmth that's coming from inside. Oh, look, what's this? The hanging mistletoe. They kiss? Why, that looks so unique. Inspired! They're gathering around, hearing story, roasting chestnuts on a fire. What's this? What's this? In here, they've got a little tree. How queer! And who would ever think? And why? They're covering it with tiny little things. They've got electric lights on strings, and there's a smile on everyone. So now correct me if I'm wrong. This looks like fun, this looks like fun. Oh, could it be? I got my wish. What's this?
In 1993, Walt Disney Studios released two Halloween movies. Hocus Pocus, starring Bette Midler, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Kathy Najimy, as three witches who threaten the children of modern-day Salem, Massachusetts, and The Nightmare Before Christmas, in which the supernatural beings who are charged with running Halloween decide that they want to try their hand at running Christmas. Hocus Pocus was not a financial success, probably in part due to it being released in July. Nightmare Before Christmas, released at the more seasonable October, fared much better at the box office and with critics. Over the years, though, both films have garnered new fans, thanks to home video. In a recent conversation, I had revealed that up until this month, I had never seen Nightmare Before Christmas. Rich was aghast as he holds Nightmare as a classic. But he confessed to me that he had never seen Hocus Pocus, which is a personal favorite of mine. And we decided that it would be a good time of the year to fix that omission and talk about our first experiences with a movie that the other enjoys. So, Rich.
Yes. Oh, no. Here we go.
Who's your favorite Sanderson sister?
Sarah.
She's mine.
Sarah. Well, yeah. I almost could have guessed that. Sarah Jessica Parker is delightful in this movie. She's just kind of bonkers nuts. She just bounces around. She says things that are just...
Come on.
She says things that are kind of, you know, just out of left field, very apropos of nothing. I don't know if you really need a comic relief character in a film that's a light comedy, but that's what she is. And she's just wonderful. She's in a whole different movie. Yeah.
And you want to see
I want to see that whole movie, because that's got to be an insane movie.
That's those.
Yeah. And she just has like this kind of manic energy that I think is just wonderful in this movie. And yes, I could see that being the character you would gravitate towards.
Oh, I have a little bit of each of them. When I wake up in the morning, I'm definitely Winifred.
Yeah, I've called you at first thing in the morning and gotten you like when you're still in bed. And I'm like, oops. And I'm like immediately knowing, oh, this call is not going to go well.
What a glorious morning.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me sick.
So let me turn that question back on you now. Who is your favorite character in Nightmare Before Christmas?
Sally, obviously. There's just something so depressingly beautiful about her.
Interesting. You mean the character herself or...
Or Catherine O'Hara?
Appearance-wise, or what do you mean exactly?
The character. She's an outsider who's kept locked away. She dreams of a better life.
A bit Rapunzel there.
Yeah. But it's Tim Burton, so you're never going to get anything that lighthearted. It's going to be a little depressing.
Yes. And weird and sad.
Yeah. I think she is, in a way, the... This is going to sound like a weird comparison. Manic pixie girl.
Okay.
She's quirky. She is beautiful. And in a way, she's there to fulfill a man's desire. Not Jack's. The doctor's.
She was created for that.
Yeah.
But she rebels against that idea.
Yeah.
Almost immediately. Mm-hmm. So in a way, she's more of a rag doll than Bride of Frankenstein, but she's very much also Bride of Frankenstein, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Jack has the same feelings. He dreams of something else, but not because he's locked away. He's not physically locked away. He has put himself in his own prison in which he feels the outsider, even when he's the head of practically everything.
He's in the prison of his job.
Yeah. A prison of his own making.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those characters find their love for each other because of that, because they're willing to step out of those cages. He steps out of it and realizes near the end that maybe he shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
She steps out of it and realizes that's where she belongs. It works differently for each of them.
True.
And I think they balance each other nicely.
Oh, most definitely. I don't think you see that kind of balance in the Sanderson sisters, though. I mean, they're all kind of their own characters. I mean, they're sisters, but I'm not quite sure they complement each other outside of, you know, Bette Midler being the smart one, the other two being dumb.
No, and that's where I disagree with you.
Okay.
There is a balance, but it's not on the top. You've got to watch this film several times before you pick up on it.
Okay.
Winifred is... She's the mean bitch. She is Regina fucking George. She's the one you don't want to mess with.
Okay.
As Billy found out. Hi, Billy. Then you have Sarah. Young, vivacious, beautiful. She's the one who all the guys are going to travel after. She is energetic. She's fun.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then you have Mary, who I'm pretty certain is the middle child.
Good observation. I do like that.
Well, I'm not done. Mary is the one who's loyal to a T, keeps everyone calm, and keeps them all from killing each other.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
I suggest we form a calming circle. I am calm. Sister, I don't think about being honest with thyself, are we? Are we? So there's a nice triangle there.
Okay.
And they need each other in their own way. Sarah needs a crutch to lean on when she's being a little more stupid than she should and needs someone to have that fun with.
Mm-hmm.
And when Winnie goes off the rails, you got Mary to pull her back.
True.
So you have a nice balance going on there.
Could you explain the one acting choice Kathy Najimini made?
The crooked mouth?
Why did she decide that she wanted to look like she was having a stroke through this whole movie?
I don't know. It was just...
I'm sorry.
On her hair. Actually, that's costume choice, but yes. Still.
It was distracting, I felt. You know?
I don't mind it so much. There's something very... Each one of them has their own quirks, okay? There's
but
Sarah and how she's
is not
made
a quirk.
Okay, here's a choice for you. Winnie's Betty Boop puckered mouth with the buck teeth.
Yeah, I can see that, though. That I don't mind. Just the whole, it looks like I'm trying to pull a funny face and I'm not quite there. It distracted me a little bit, I think, with
you
the character.
You over-focus on some things too much.
Maybe I do. That's a possibility.
I think because Mary doesn't get as much screen time as the other two, I think she was trying to find something that makes her stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And she has this energy. And for some odd reason, it always comes from it's like the kiss in Peter Pan. It's like right there in the corner of her mouth. And I like it. I look at her and I can feel whatever that is. And so I don't mind it so much. It doesn't bother me.
Okay. One thing, though, that really bothered me, I'm going into this thinking, okay, this is more of a kid's movie than like Nightmare Before Christmas. And let's face it, they straight up murder a kid right at the beginning of this movie.
They do.
And I even texted you or messaged you or something. I was like, holy shit, did they just murder that girl?
Yes, they did.
They basically did. And I mean, I get it. It gives motivation for a character. It kind of sets stakes for, you know, that these three witches are at least semi-competent enough to cast a spell that will suck the life force out of a child. They don't make it too horrific. They don't, like, you know, make the kid kind of like get all withery up and turn to dust or anything like that. Or that would really freak a kid out, you know, watching this movie. And they don't kind of call too much attention to it, too.
No.
But they straight up...
They blanket over, sucking the lies out of little children.
But they straight up murder a child.
Yes, they murdered a little girl in front of her brother.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is pretty horrific. And, you know, so I'm not sure I quite have a problem with this or not, because they kind of play the witches, the sisters, as kind of comically bumbling for the rest of the movie. So you're like, kind of undercuts their danger, their menace a little bit, but they still straight up murdered a child in the beginning of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if the movie really wants to have its cake and eat it too.
They know how to play the comedy, so it's really terrifying. For example, it's a fun scene when Bette Midler is singing, I put a spell on you. But guess what? She's actually casting a curse over the adults of Salem to literally dance until they die, which we see at the end, on the end credits.
Yeah.
Them walking out. They're freaking exhausted because if those witches had not been killed.
Yeah, the parents would have been dead. The kids would have been dead. The whole town. Dead.
Yeah, exactly.
So they do have, you know, those moments in the film that raise the stakes for what the three kids are trying to do.
And the kids putting the Sanderson sisters practically in an oven and cooking them alive.
Mm-hmm.
There are dark parts to this film.
Oh, gosh,
the one that used to get me is when Max and Allison come back upstairs into the house.
Okay.
And he goes to check on Danny, and Sarah jumps out of the bed, and then they come out.
Oh, yeah, that's a good jump scare.
Yeah, though that scene freaked me out, and it does. They know how to play dark and comedic at the exact same time, because that's a great jump scare, and then it's like, boy, down.
there's a couple of jump scares in there that I was just like, ooh, that's nicely done. And they're not too horrific. They're not too overdone in your face that they would just totally make, you know, like a 10-year-old in the theater crap their pants or anything. but they were just enough to give a kid a good jump. And then they undercut it with a comedy or a light moment. So the kid feels automatically relaxed about it. Mm. I would say it's a good kind of beginner horror movie almost for children without it being too horrific. And there's absolutely nothing gory in this movie at all. No blood or, you know, anything like that.
The floorboards, when he lit the black flame candle, that used to get me as a kid too, with those floorboards going like that. And I'm like, holy shit, we're all going to die.
I like just the special effect of the black flame. That looked really great. Mm-hmm. The effect work in here is fantastic, I think.
The cat.
The cat talking. I mean, obviously I'm sitting there going, yes, this is obviously animated, but it's really well done.
Yes and no. It was a mix of the two, at least according to the 25th anniversary's reunion special that aired on Freeform Saturday night, actually.
You just only told me about that today, so I haven't had a chance to go and catch up with that. And while I'm not in love with this movie, that's something I do want to watch just to kind of get the actors' impressions on what they did 25 years ago.
And to see how far some of these actors have come. Thor Birch, who played Danny, went on to do Patriot Games. And her big turn, American Beauty.
I was going to say Dungeons and Dragons.
Go away.
No, that's a garbage movie and we're all going to forget I ever said that.
Yes, please do. Yes. Allison had, there was a movie she did with Joaquin Phoenix and Gwyneth Paltrow called, I believe it was called Two Lovers. She did L.A. Without a Map with David Tennant, Johnny Depp. The remake of 310 to Yuma, she had a moment in. And then Sean Murray, who played the live action version of Thackeray Binks, has been a series regular on NCIS since its beginning.
If you had seen Nightmare Before Christmas at roughly the same time that you first saw Hocus Pocus, what in there would you have found scary?
All of it.
Really?
I mean,
you're a big Christmas fan, so obviously the stuff where Christmas gets attacked,
oh my God,
quote unquote, probably wouldn't have settled well with you.
It was actually a couple of my friends who sat me down and had me watch it last week for the first time. And when they were torturing these toys and creating their own twisted versions and the dolly getting guillotined, I was wrapped up in a blanket sitting on the floor. I just, my face, and they started laughing. And I just turned to them and I'm like, you're mocking me. And they're like, no, we're not mocking you. It's
no?
And then Santa, what they're doing to poor Santa. It's just not, and I just turned into a 5-year-old little girl sitting up curled on a sofa, but I don't care. It's Santa.
Aw. I would have thought like maybe Oogie Boogie, like especially when he.
The Oogie Boogie bugs, not really.
Really? Because that goes like, ugh.
As much as the opening song is awesomely cool, I don't think that's a phrase, I just said it. It's frightening. And I grew up watching Exorcist, Life Force, Sleepy Hollow, From Hell, Ninth Gate. I had some good horror like early on in life. And I'm talking like between the ages of 4 and 8. American Werewolf in London at age 10, though, was just a no-no. And then there are other films that feel like they were a beginner's film to horror. Watcher in the Woods, you know I've spoken about this one before.
Oh, yeah.
It terrified me as a kid. I love it now. Something Wicked This Way Comes will never be in my house. I don't care if that film was technically meant for kids. It's never going to be in my house. So there are moments in Nightmare Before Christmas I feel would have been disturbing. But because of the other things I saw as a kid, I could handle it a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the scenes where they're really attacking Christmas. That's what kills me. But there are some beautiful shots in this movie. Jack in the arms of that angel in the cemetery.
Yes.
That is a stunning shot. And I was so impressed by it.
And that's always a case where, okay, Tim Burton produced this, and obviously a lot of this is based on his designs and everything, so it's going to have a very Tim Burton-y feel to it.
It's always the opening of the Tim Burton films for some reason that get me. Like the opening of Sleepy Hollow, when Van Garrett is running through the cornfield and finds the scarecrow with the pumpkin on its head. There's just something so sinister about the way that jack-o'-lantern was done that scared the shit out of me as a kid. And then we get to the main credits, and I'm like, oh, this Danny Elfman music's really good. This movie's going to be amazing. And then the rest of the film's awesome. But the beginning still kind of gets to me.
but for Nightmare, though, it's directed by Henry Selick, who also directed James and the Giant Peach and did a lot of other stop-motion stuff.
James and the Giant Peach as a kid.
So it's I always kind of wonder how much of the visual style and the look and things like Jack in the Arms of the Angel in the Cemetery is Tim Burton or is it Henry Selick?
Could be both.
Or is it, you know, a combination? I don't know how that works.
I'm not very well versed in stop motion. I own Corpse Bride. It's not one of my favorite movies, but I would watch it every now and again. I have not seen Coraline, although I've heard amazing things about it.
Coraline's fantastic, and that's also Henry Selick, though.
I figured. but stop motion is just, it's not something I've always been drawn to, so I can't really have the best opinion about it one way or another.
Okay.
I can only say what I can about Nightmare and Corpse Bride. Both have Tim Burton influences, both are stop motion. They're the only two I can compare now. I will say I do prefer for Corpse Bride. Even though there are more beautiful shots in Nightmare, I definitely prefer Corpse Bride as a story. It took me forever to figure out what Nightmare Before Christmas was even about. I paid more attention to the character than the actual story because I couldn't find the story.
Okay, it does kind of take a while for Jack to discover Christmas and things really get going. There's a lot of groundwork. The movie does take a lot of time to explore Halloween Town. I think probably to kind of get you in the mindset of what Christmas Town is going to be. That it's just a town that's dedicated to one holiday and making sure that holiday happens. You can't just get through Halloween Town and get Jack to find the doorway to Christmas Town inside of like 12 minutes. You kind of have to take a little bit of time to explain that world and its rules so you can follow along. But yeah, it is a long, drawn out first act.
Yeah, it is. And I don't mind slow burns, but I have problems with slow burns if they're not going anywhere.
I'm trying to find, though, I was hoping that, you know, in our discussion, we could kind of come up with a way these films kind of work hand in hand. And I'm not sure I really do. You know, one's just a straight-up adventure film. Hocus Pocus is a straight-up adventure film for the kids. It does a lot of interesting things, but I'm not sure there's like a bigger theme to Hocus Pocus, unless I'm missing something. You know, Jack obviously learns about other things and realizes that he needs to be, you know, how to be content in his own life. That's the theme of Nightmare Before Christmas. Now, maybe because I've only watched it once and it was less than 24 hours ago, so I haven't had a whole long time to sit with it. But for me, Hocus Pocus, it's a fun adventure, but I'm not sure there's anything deeper than that. Or what am I missing?
What are you missing? A lot.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no. I take that back. The second you said that, I'm realizing, yeah, no, we've got the brother learning to take responsibility for protecting his younger sister.
Which is a theme that is doubled twice in this film.
Yes, yes. So we do have that. So he does have that character arc of learning how to, you know, not love his sister, but, you know, be a better brother to her.
There's also don't mess with things you don't understand, which you they learn in a very hard way.
Which I guess makes a parallel to Nightmare Before Christmas, because Jack's messing with Christmas and he didn't understand it at all.
Mm-hmm. And the worst part is he was messing with things he didn't understand to impress a girl and it nearly killed his sister. He had to learn about consequences.
And Jack does, too. So, yeah, I guess there are some similarities here. Okay. I'm glad we talked this out. A couple of other observations of random stuff that I have here.
If you go with Gary Marshall and Penny Marshall, siblings praying husband and wife.
Yeah, that was...
they actually referenced that at the reunion.
but there's a couple like little things, you know, little saucy moments that Hocus Pocus plays with that kind of surprised me. Like the stuff with the bus driver.
the cop and his girlfriend who walked out of the liquor store thought I was a real cop.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a nice little twist on that scene. One thing I did like was, you know, they go, oh, a virgin had to light the candle to set the spell in motion. And so we have this high schooler kid who's trying to be cool, trying to impress this girl. they don't make anything out of the fact that he's the virgin outside of just, okay, he's a virgin.
What happened? A virgin lit the candle.
Yeah, there wasn't any like mocking of him for being a virgin.
The cop did mock him.
Well, the cop, yeah. But I mean, among his peer group, the girl didn't look, you know, Allison didn't look at him like, oh, you're a virgin, you know, I don't want anybody who doesn't know the equipment down there. You know, nothing like that.
It's a kid's movie. Of course they're not going to do that.
They didn't. And I mean, they could have a little bit, but it's a kid's movie. So if they're not going to make any hay out of it, why mention that he's a virgin? It was just a odd choice. You know, they could have said something, you know, like, you know, the outsider will light the candle and, oh yeah, he's from LA or something like that.
It's their way of doing like the blood of the virgin sacrifice thing in a way that doesn't hurt your main character.
Mm-hmm.
There is something very powerful about a virgin. Virgin's blood, virgin's tears. These are things that is seen over and over and over in film, mythology, everything.
Not that I'm condemning the movie. I'm certainly not. You know, I'm just trying to figure out this choice. But if it's a kid's movie, you're not going to go into what a virgin is or anything like that or make too much meat out of it. But at the same time, why use the phrase virgin when you could use, you know, the chaste or something like that, where you could say, what does that mean? Oh, it just means he hasn't kissed a girl. And then you have Allison going, huh? Or something like that. You could play with that idea.
Because this
film in slightly less charged ways, I think.
Because whilst it is a kid's film,
mm-hmm.
it was also marketed to teenagers and adults.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't see it. As a kid in the theater, obviously, I wasn't born yet. That was a year and a half later. But it was my mom and my dad who showed me that film. It wasn't so much that my sister, who was a few years older than me, went, oh, you have to watch Hocus Pocus because she was a kid when it came out. No, it was my parents, which means that these 30-year-olds went to see Hocus Pocus, and therefore they're passing it along to me.
Okay.
And I, in turn, have passed it along to my stepsons. And it's us as adults showing it to our kids, showing it to our teenagers. And sometimes they ask questions, sometimes they don't. Why? Because, to be honest, in today's generation, most kids know what a virgin is.
Well, yeah. No, I'm looking at it from like 1993 point of view.
I saw it when I was about 4 or 5, and I knew what a virgin was.
Oh, boy.
I'd seen enough movies.
Once again, I need to talk to your mother. Long conversation.
Well, I saw it around the same time that I saw Matrix Reloaded.
Oh, jeepers.
So I didn't even need to, she didn't even need to explain it. I saw it.
Oh my God.
Did you just facepalm?
Hey, pretty much. I double facepalm.
So yeah, there are some things in there that they play with for the kids. There is some in there for the teenagers, like Ice.
Yeah.
And whoever the hell the other one is.
I got a little sad when I saw Charles Rocket as the dad.
Aw.
He was on the first cast after the original cast on Saturday Night Live. So with like Anne Risley, Gilbert Godfrey, Denny Dillon, he was the first person to say fuck on that show. Good going there. That was February of 81. But also, you know, he tragically took his life later on, a few years back. And he was on Moonlighting a couple years before he was in this. He was on a couple of episodes of Moonlighting playing Bruce Willis's brother, Richie. And so he did good work there. He was on Max Headroom playing an evil network executive on a couple of episodes. I always found him to be a good actor, an enjoyable actor. I've always enjoyed him. You know, when I see him, his SNL persona was kind of a bit swarmy. He always seemed to be playing swarmy guys. So I didn't like what I saw of him there so much. But I don't think he ever quite got the breaks maybe he should have. And, you know, I don't know if it was a case of Hollywood not recognizing his talent, his agent screwing him up. Maybe he screwed himself up. I don't know. Whenever I do get to see him in something, I always feel a little sad about that. I'm like, oh, he's doing some good work here. And it's just not going to move him along in his career, unfortunately. Just knowing how, you know, the tragic ending of his life, too. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring everything down on a bummer note here.
No, you're good. You're fine.
So, lasting legacy of these two films. Do you think that it's deserved?
I don't know if you're going to hate me for this or not. Setting aside my personal preferences, because I enjoyed both films, I honestly think Nightmare Before Christmas is a more solid film.
And I happen to go the other way.
Okay. And that might just be a case of each of us having seen the film we're championing a lot of times and the other film just once.
Well, to talk to Freeform's 31 Days of Christmas, they practically play Hocus Pocus every night. Nightmare Before Christmas only gets in maybe about 5 times in the... But no, they're both marketed heavy during the Halloween season. Nightmare Before Christmas costumes have been around forever, and I've been seeing them everywhere.
That was the one that always had more popularity right from the start. Hocus Pocus has slowly built up, you know, its reputation,
worldwide phenomena.
Yeah.
I gotta admit, I was at the Halloween store the other day. I'm going as Morticia Adams for this year's Halloween, but I have put off getting a costume for like ever. And so I was at the store over the past couple days looking for one, and I can't find one. So I gotta admit, I was just thinking, shit, I'm gonna go as a Sanderson sister. Maybe I can get a couple people to dress and drag. I don't know. I just...
I dare say I'd like to see your husband in drag going, come on.
Hey, that was gonna be me. Goes Mary. Goes to the cracked mouth.
But I can definitely see where Hocus Pocus does have its fans. You know, even among, you know, friends of mine from college, I remember, you know, were fans of the movie. You know, they saw it right around when it came out, and you know, they had mentioned to me, and I was like, okay. But
you never got around to it.
No, I didn't until this week. Until 24 hours ago.
When it comes to film stuff, Kenny Ortega,
the director of Hocus Pocus.
Yes. I am familiar with his work over, and he's worked with Disney for a very long time. A lot of his stuff hasn't been received all that well until
the High School Musical stuff, one of the Cheetah Girls movies, and
now you're gonna ask.
I spent a year when I was married having to watch a lot of this stuff. my stepdaughter was that age where it was just like High School Musical, Cheetah Girls, iCarly, all any of that stuff. So
Zoe 101?
Probably. It all became a weird blur after a while.
I was a Lizzie McGuire girl.
And it was kind of, oh, she was into Lizzie McGuire as well.
Lizzie McGuire and That's So Raven. I was the year was, right before High School Musical.
And it was kind of like, okay, 9:30 she goes to bed. Now the adults can watch something. What's on Turner Classics? But I've seen other things besides Newsies and this and the that Rocky Horror Picture Show live version that he did for Fox a year or two ago, which I really did not like all that much.
There has been some rumors going around that there is a possibility of a Hocus Pocus 2. I don't want it.
Okay.
Yes, Danny went on to do other things. Allison went to do on other things. Max has not. He retired in 2002 from Hollywood after working since the 80s, starting on Dallas as a main cast member.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could technically do another Hocus Pocus film and have the sisters come back. Doug Jones come back as Billy Butcherson. Give him a bigger, meatier section of the part this time.
And Max and Allison's kids could be being harassed by these witches now.
If you're not going to have those three come back, and when I say those three, I mean Max, Allison, and Danny. First, as much as you love the Sanderson sisters, Max, Allison, and Danny, for me, are the core of that film.
Oh, yeah.
And you cannot do a Hocus Pocus sequel or reboot or anything without those three being the center.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I think sticking it in today's society is not going to fare up as well. We live in a cultural society now where the villain is your next door neighbor, where we don't trick or treat anymore. We trunk or treat. And therefore, I feel like some of this, it won't hold if you tried to reboot it, if you tried to do something like that. Halloween is terrifying now. I mean, as a kid, I remember my parents always checking my candy when I came home. And there was always a fear that someone's swapped a Smarties for a prescription pill.
Which I always found ridiculous. I was like, you know how much drugs cost? No one's giving them out for free. No one's giving drugs to kids for free. I spent good money on this LSD. I'm not going to, you know, dose some kid's Snickers bar. I would imagine is what they would say.
But but there is that fear.
Yeah, and there is, unfortunately.
And so letting kids go out trick-or-treating with their older brother or whatever is not going to hold up now. I think it holds up in this film over time because this film has become a classic. It is dark. It is light. It teaches about the bond between a brother and sister. It teaches the consequences of not knowing where to draw the line when it comes to impressing girls and for knowing consequences and how far are you willing to accept those consequences.
It's a very nice time capsule of the early 90s in a way. Whereas I think on its own merits as a classic, Nightmare Before Christmas is kind of divorced from
It's a
specific time period. So, yeah, it mentions kids trick-or-treating, but it's not like an important plot point. It just says, you know, oh, this is what happens at Halloween. Sometimes kids go trick-or-treating, and then it gets to Christmas time, and obviously certain things around Christmas may change here and there, but the idea of giving presents and decorating and things like that are kind of, dare I say, evergreen to Christmas.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so they both work on their own merits, and they both have some interesting similarities, I think we found today.
And that about wraps it up for this week.
Yes, indeed. Now, remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search, and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review, because that always helps us connect with new listeners. We'll be back next week with more news analysis.
And that's all right here on the Big Picture Podcast.